Natural Resources Subcommittee meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and we're here today to continue the public hearing on Senate Bill 5518, which is the budget bill for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We are doing the agency program and services detail, and before I call the director forward, Mr. Rocco, do you have any announcements for the committee?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to hand out something the agency provided in response to the pot limitation issue that's been discussed the last couple meetings. And this is a material that was prepared by the Marine Resources Program of the agency, and I will pass that out now.
Thank you. Could we have Director Lindsey Ball come forward and any staff people that you wish to bring with you? And as I recall, we were concluding the fish screening program presentation.
Madam Chair, can I ask an informational question?
Most definitely.
Is this subcommittee considering doing something about pot limits, or is this just for information only?
Madam Chair, Senator Dukes, I believe this is just a response to some issues that were brought up by Representative Krieger, I believe, the other day.
Okay, because I have some rather strong feelings that when we did limits and entry crab, this was an offer that was made and was adamantly turned down because they didn't want us, they didn't want any part of it. That those of us who shed blood over that issue may not necessarily be interested in shedding any more blood. Plus, this is an industry issue, not an agency issue.
I think we should keep it to 10 plants.
10 what?
Plants.
10 plants.
Pot.
I'm sorry. I'm slow. It's Friday. Thank you.
You've been really zinging a lot lately.
Sorry. I'll try to catch on to ask you next time.
Good morning, Director.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, my name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me at the table today is Ray Hartlerode from our screenings program, and he is here to respond to any questions that the committee might have.
Madam Chair, I'll start.
Go for it, Senator Dukes.
Do we have a screening plan? I've asked this of all the other folks who've come along, so I just wanted to know. It seems to me that whenever the federal government gives us money, we try to make sure that we can get some of that for our hatcheries or for some other thing, and then we screen. And we actually had a bill once requiring that agricultural folks would screen, and we'd do a cost share with them. But is there some overall screening list and plan to get there?
Chair Morgan, Senator Dukes, I believe 2 years ago, the Fish Bowl Task Force, with their assistance and ODFW, put together a 10-year plan to screen the over 3,000 diversions that are left to be screened in the state. We have that plan. It also prioritized the screens, the diversions that needed to be screened at that time. Since then, quite a few populations have become on the endangered species list, and so that needs to be redone as far as prioritization. One of the things we hope to do if we get the Fisheries Restoration and Irrigation Mitigation Act federal dollars, the first money earmarked out of that would be for additional inventory and prioritization work. So, yes, we do have a plan, and that's our goal, is to try and get everything screened within the next 10 years.
Do you know how you're going to do that? I mean, does the agency have a funding request or an expectation of federal funds or something? Have we matched the needs list up with a way of getting it done?
Chair Morgan, Senator Dukes, in the last biennium, we were on top of the statewide cost share funds that we get from the license surcharge dollars and general fund, which administers the program. We received $4 million of lottery funds through OWEP. If we were to continue to receive those kinds of funds for the next 10 years, coupled with the federal mitigation funds, irrigation mitigation funds, I would see no problem in screening all of those diversions within the next 10 years.
But 10 years. How many fish do we lose in the next 10 years?
Potentially many. To give you a number.
We had consideration of maybe speeding that up a little bit, or has somebody talked about it internally and said, can't do that because, or yeah, we'd like to do that, or... I mean, you're only 4 years ahead of the hatchery program. At 14 years, if they keep the funding that they've got these days, in 14 years we'll have it.
Chair Morgan, Senator Dukes, the 10-year plan is speeded up from what we envisioned before. On the statewide program, the mandate is to screen 75 per year. Well, that would have taken 30 years. The 10-year plan is the speeded up version.
It's the speeded up version. Okay. Madam Chair, I'm not trying to badger the witness here. In some ways, I want to say it's not the agency's fault, but in other ways, I think that the agency ought to be coming forward, and this is about the fourth time you've heard me say this now, Lindsay, and requesting funds to be able to get this done. I mean, we say we're serious about protecting fish, and yet if we know it's going to take us 10 years to get the diversion screened, which is one of the simplest methods of protecting the fish available to us, and I keep saying that you ought to be coming forward and asking us for the money to do what you know needs to be done, and then it falls to us to decide whether or not we do that. But as long as the agency holds back because they don't think they're going to get it or for whatever reason holds back, 10 years of continuing to allow something that we have identified as being not a good thing, I don't see how that affects fish. So I think they ought to bring it all to us, and then it's us up to us in cooperation with the agency to sort it all out.
Senator Dukes, I share your concerns on this, and what I see happening from my limited time that I've been looking at this is that the program has been designed around the money flow rather than around the needs. And I think that your comments are very well taken, that we don't have a comprehensive picture of the need and what the priorities are within the whole picture of the need. And we can't, I think, go at this in a way that is reasoned and deal with the places where we can essentially get the biggest bang for the buck first, because we don't have this overall plan. And I know that even in the last funding cycle, the agency, not all the money was spent that was dedicated to this this area. And so I have a real concern that you share, that we've identified an area where we can actually lower fish mortality significantly. We have the technical expertise to do it. I don't think that we have the capacity to manufacture the stuff or the capacity to analyze and figure out what fits for specific instances. But I am very concerned that we don't have an overall plan so that we're doing this in a reasonable and rational way.
Great.
Representative Hayden.
Actually, I have a different philosophy on that, and I think I got it from a little agency called Dogami, who would always ask for a little less than they really needed. And I would say, why don't you ask for more? And they said, well, budgets are tight, and it has to be shared out. And particularly with term limits, I really question, Madam Chair, whether the legislature would be able to sort through what is the real need. If we could do that, we would go to zero-based budgeting. But we don't. We generally just pretty well accept what the agency says they have to have, and most of them ask for more than they really need. And we usually give it to them. So if there's an agency that's really trying to be frugal and good stewards and really ask for what they think is reasonable given the state of the budget, I think that's good stewardship. So a little different spin.
Chair, could I, Senator, comment? The problem here is we're on the brink, I believe, of losing our fish hatcheries, of having potential. I mean, we have the 40 rules, and a lot of those kinds of things are based on a certain number of expectations. And my fear is that we're going to lose more if we don't make the investments and do the easy stuff, that there will be more listings, or it will, or the regulations will take longer to get rid of because it will take us longer to be able to recover the species. And we did have for two interims, a joint committee, yeah, for two interims and a legislative session or two, we had a joint House and Senate committee that engaged in a lot of trying to find solutions over fish-related issues. I hope we will have that again this interim. I don't know. And engaged with the agency. So I think we have the ability to sort some of that stuff out. Normally, I would agree with Representative Hayden that we don't want to encourage agencies to do more than they can, but I think in this one we have to tell them to come forward and ask.
And I think that also that personally I'm not interested in having the legislature control the priority of the list for fish screening, but I think that if there was a comprehensive look at the whole problem, then the legislature, in partnership with the expertise within the agency, would be able to more sensibly allocate the funding that was available to work on the problem. Yeah.
It's like a ping pong game, isn't it? You get to just want to go back and forth.
Chair Morgan, may I
maybe
address your comment on capacity and, the dollars spent in the last biennium. Capacity, you're absolutely right. The state in our screen shops does not have the capacity to get this job done. And, we've really made a change in the program, I think, in this last biennium. And I've made sure that from the technician on up to the screen shop managers in the program, everyone understands that in order to create more capacity and get these diversion screened, we need to use the private sector more. And I had the opportunity when I first came on in this position last fall to come before the SR Squared Committee, and I heard that direction loud and clear that that's where we wanted to go, and I completely agree with it, that that is the only way we're going to get these diversion screened is to use the private sector more. And we've done quite a bit in the last biennium once we got the program going. It took a while to get it up and running, and really we didn't really get to start hiring people until close to July. July was when we hired the three coordinators. And then in that 1 year since then, we've used about $2 million. So I think we're on track. That's about the capacity of the program right now, but as we bring more and more private contractors in, I think we're going to greatly increase our capacity to get screens done.
I've been one of the people that have been hitting on that concept fairly heavily, and I look around my legislative district, and every small town has at least one machine shop that used to fabricate for the sawmill and logging industry and dynamite fabricators that do a great job. And I don't see a reason in the world why they wouldn't be real pleased to turn part of their operation or all of their operation over to fabricating fish screens. And I'm very glad to hear that the agency's moving in that direction, because I strongly share Senator Dukes's perception that this is a place where we know we can make a big difference, and the faster that we move into it, the faster we're going to impact and lower fish mortality.
Chair Martin, I completely agree with you, and I think that as we get a good cohesive program running, it's taken some time. It's been a change in the way the state has done business in screens for many years. But as we get that going and are using private contractors, have more and more private contractors interested in working on this and have them, for lack of a better term, trained in the art of producing fish screens that will protect fish, I think the capacity is going to grow, and I think then we would certainly be coming back and hopefully requesting more funds as much as we can use at the time with using private contractors.
How does a private business that wants to manufacture fish screens get into the fish screen manufacturing business?
Representative Morgan, Chair Morgan, basically, if they contact us, we're right now we're currently producing a list of not only construction contractors, but also fabrication contractors, any engineering consultants that are interested in being involved in the program. And every water user that we approach, we provide that to them, give them the opportunity to hire any of those people they want, and we'll still fund the 60% of the cost. We also then, as we get into some of the screens that we feel we need to engineer and contract, then we look to that list to provide. And we're doing more of that in the engineering section in Fish Division is currently producing, going through the DAS process to set up a list of qualified engineering firms that we can call on to engineer and contract out some more of our engineering. That's currently kind of one of our bottlenecks is the engineering for many of these screens.
Does every fish screen need to be engineered? I mean, is there like the JCPenney's catalog of fish screening devices somewhere that you can just find one that fits your application?
Chair Morgan, we're going to make a catalog. That is one of the other things we're doing. We're trying to, as we get screens designed, you're right, no, not all the diversion screens for diversions need to be re-engineered. We have most of the screens really are small drum screens or pump screens that are purchased from manufacturers, and those certainly don't need to be engineered. The small rotary drum screens that we use on smaller ditches, we have that. But one of the things we're doing is to try and develop sets of plans and specifications for various types of screens because they, you know, one screen doesn't fit all. And we want to have that available for contractors or municipalities, whoever wants to build a screen, that we can give them those plans and specs so that they can either construct it themselves or have something so they readily can contract it out on themselves. We're working towards that, yes.
Representative Chair, just a couple comments. Yesterday we had a discussion on oil tank removal, and part of the discussion was the number of people that are entering that field. I think the private sector will respond to whatever the situation is and do the work. If there's a lot of screen work available, people will convert their machine shops to do it, contractors will get involved. I mean, it's a good source. Maybe what's needed, one, is the revenue so that they know that there's a consistent stream of revenue going into this area, and possibly a cutoff that for the people that need to put screens in, yeah, if you do it in the next 6 years, the state will pay 80%. If it drags beyond that, it'll be more likely you'll be paying a larger part. But to give an incentive for people to move quickly, and then there's just no question the private industry will respond. One, if we're creating that much work, it's not like everybody is so busy in these areas that there's not a place for new activity. That certainly happened with oil tank removals. I mean, once it became that this is a real important thing that's going to have to be done, a lot of people moved into it, and it's pretty technical, but there were a lot of other type of backhoe operations, excavators and stuff that decided this is a good secondary or a better economic activity to be involved in, and it happened. But I think we need to have a policy debate in terms of what the cutoff should be and what the incentives are. And then the market will respond to it.
Thank you.
One other question in terms of a plan. One of the things I've wondered in looking at, I think we had information, there's about 3,000 installations that need to be made, and we started making 75 a year, and now we've upgraded 400 last year. The question I had is, are these the most strategic 450 that we're doing? Would it be better if you concentrated the whole 450 in one watershed where you could really see what the impact would be is it better to be concentrating on a lot of small projects or are a couple big projects? Where do you get the most bang for the buck? But until you have some type of a plan, those types of policy decisions, and I don't care whether the legislature makes them or maybe it's more appropriate for the commission or for an advisory committee, until you've laid it out, then no one is making those decisions. I think I've got Bill to care.
Would you like to comment on that?
Chair Morgan, Representative Hansen, and others. Really, what we're trying to react to is all of the these diversions that needs green in ESA listed areas, and they're basically across the state. If mostly anadromous, but there are also bull trout in some of our eastern Oregon areas that don't have anadromous fish. And we have many ranchers and irrigators coming and asking for assistance. So really, I guess right now our plan has been to try to provide that service to those that are, you know, willing to cooperate, and in those areas where there's ESA listed fish. You know, really one of my goals is that there not be any federal enforcement action against an irrigator if they want to cooperate in the screens program. So while I think you're right, and in some areas we've tried to consolidate our screening work to take advantage of long reaches of those streams. At the same time, we're trying to react to the request by the landowners and irrigators across the state in those ESA areas.
Senator Dukes.
Seems to me that I remember a conversation before the SR2 committee about, as it relates to private industry getting involved, that there was a shop that was doing fabrication of some of our screens, a private shop, but mostly we did our own. Something to do with the way we put up the bids for the screens, that we were using a material that most companies didn't want to deal with, which may just be the way the ball bounces, that if that's the material we have to use, but also that we weren't putting bids out for a lot of screens at one time, and it wasn't worth the private company's time to retool to do screens when we were saying we wanted one of these and two of those out of that catalog we were just talking about. I'm hoping that we have rethought that process somehow, because we're not able in our little fabrication shop to produce enough screens, so I think we need private industry's help. Even if, I mean, that's above and beyond that whole discussion of who ought to be doing it. So I'm just hoping we've rethought how we put these things out for bid so that private industry is encouraged to participate in this.
Chair Morgan, Senator Dukes, I don't recall the issue over materials. I do recall some of the discussion over, you know, the quantity to make it pay for a contractor. One of the things we've done is to try it where we can on some of these smaller irrigation diversions, go to a portable, and some of the information I provided to you earlier showed a portable screen manufactured by the Koffler Boat Company out of Eugene. They've produced two of those now, and they're interested in producing more, and we're working with them to fine-tune the seals and the way that works. And those, then, they could produce them there at their shop, and we will take them out wherever they need to be installed. It is a concern. There are many of these screens out in isolated areas that have to be built on site, then that is a problem. And one of the things we've done there is to try to either rebuild the screen, and we hire, if we're able to, hire a contractor to do the concrete work, or vice versa. We've done both, and try and merge our program with the private sector on many of the screens. As a matter of fact, I reported earlier, 87% of the screens installed had some component of private contracting in it, and it's whatever we could get done by the private sector. It may be the excavation work or the concrete work or fabrication or a mixture of all of those.
I want to discuss for a while how the funding flows and the accountability within the fish screening program. Can you talk to us about how you know where you are in your budgeting and how you track expenses against projects? And what I'm real concerned about is within the fish screening program, who controls the financial information, and how do we as legislators know that the money is being spent in the way that it should, and that there is a paper trail and an accountability trail?
Chair Morgan, I believe two sessions ago, I believe it was the 95-97 session, you know, I'm fairly new to the program, but I believe it was then that the legislature, through statute or budget note, I'm not sure which, provided the screening program with a halftime accountant. And that accountant, it's a little different, I think, maybe than other programs. It does not reside in the screening program. That position actually resides and is supervised by ASD in the Administrative Services Division, but solely works for the screening program. And that accountant.
But he's in the headquarters building?
She is, yes.
Okay.
And so all of the work that's done on the screens, the expenditures comes through, obviously through the regular accounting system, but for individual projects to account for the funds spent on individual project is tracked by that person.
Are the fish screening funds held in a separate account, or are they commingled with the agency's general account?
As far as I know, those are separate accounts, and I think there's a couple. Of course, there's the federal funds. There's the fish screening sub-account that is separate and dedicated. And then there's the funds that we received from OWEB this past biennium.
And how do you, as the head of the program, what kind of information do you see, and what kind of information are you looking to track?
Chair Morgan, there's the certainly the overall budget amounts for those different fund sources, and that's provided to me on cost center details from the Administrative Services Division, but then also the individual projects, the accounting for those, and that is provided to me by that account. I rely heavily on that accountant that resides in ASD for any of the budget or expenditure figures I need.
How do you build a budget?
Really, based on the money we have, probably have had in the past, I think, is primarily how that's been done. Again, you know, being new to the program, I haven't, most of that was done before I came on, but really, so it's been based on the funds that we have or have had in the past, and how many screens within weeks we expect we can get done based on that. Also, you know, of course, the personnel and S&S supply and services that's required by those screen shops.
Thank you. Are there any further questions on the fish screening program? Thank you. Oh, you have a further comment.
Chair Morgan, no, I just wanted to make sure that I brought copies of the 99-2001 Biennial Report on Fish Screening Activities. Possibly you have them, but I wanted to make sure that everybody has.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, before you leave this topic, there's been a letter provided to the committee from signed by, I think, all of the Oregon congressional members regarding the Fisheries Restoration and Irrigation Mitigation Act of 2000, which is requesting $25 million federal money for screening activities in the Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington region, which I'll provide to the committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Before they leave, is there, and it's probably buried in here somewhere, is there a two-pager on what needs to be done yet? It's like we have this inventory, a backlog on maintenance and hatcheries. Is there a backlog inventory on what needs to be screened, I mean, watershed by watershed, or I guess that wouldn't be a one-pager, but area by area, or county by county, or region by region, or
something, or even just a thing that says there's 3,000 of them we have to do yet, and 1,000 of them are the little kind, and the, you know, 500 are the medium, and 500 are the big kind, and they're going to cost us this much. Is there something of that?
Chair Morgan, Senator Dukes, yeah, I believe I provided some of that information in my testimony, but what it is, there's over 3,000 diversions, and this is based on that survey that was done by Oregon Water Resources and ODFW jointly several years ago. Out of that 3,000, I believe about 290 were over the 30 CFS, 30 cubic feet per second size, and the remainder were under 30 CFS. I believe, I'm trying to remember here, but I believe it was an estimate of $22 million to screen those that were under 30 CFS, and $118 million to screen those 290 large diversions.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crow.
Thank you. I'm looking at this publication. Page 43, you give a comparison between ODF and W and contractor. I guess I'm having some difficulty in understanding what you're really trying to say here. The reason I say that is because you've got concrete at ODF and W at $141 and a contractor at $234. Why would there be any difference at all unless you get some kind of really special deal being the state? Talking the same amount of concrete for the same project, aren't you?
Chair Morgan, Representative Kraft, you're correct. You're talking about the same amount of concrete. The difference is that this is concrete in place, which means that it also involves the labor, forming, all of those things associated with putting the concrete civil works in place. And so probably what you're seeing here is the difference in labor costs for state employees versus private contracting.
Okay, so Madam Chair, if you skip down to concrete finishers, labor per hour, you're telling me it costs twice as much, over twice as much an hour for a contractor to hire than a state employee per hour?
I believe that's what this says. I believe so.
Madam Chair, I just don't buy it. I'm sorry, and I'm not questioning your honor and your integrity here at all. Please don't think that I am. I'm not in any way. I would just like to see how you arrived at these figures in terms of cost comparison. I can't buy that. I'm sorry.
I think that the representative has raised a very good point, and I would be very pleased if you would prepare the background on these numbers and explain to us how you came to these conclusions.
Representative Martin. Chairman, Representative Kraft, I'd be glad to do that, but I may add that I believe some of these figures come from Bureau of Labor and Industries, and if it's done with federal money, federal Davis-Bacon wages that, you know, over certain size screens, you know, when we contract out, we need to charge, or the contractor needs to pay those Davis-Bacon or Boley wages.
I'm interested in seeing that information. It would be great. Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Thank you very much. Mr. Director, I believe next we have Lieutenant Koch from the OSP Fish and Wildlife Division.
Chair Morgan and members of the committee, that is correct. The sausage cat. The Department of Fish and Wildlife does not enforce fish and wildlife laws. They contract with the Department of State Police, who has authority to enforce fish and wildlife laws, and it's part of our program. And definitely the Fish and Wildlife Division and the State Police are a partner with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife as we manage our fish and wildlife at Oregon.
Thank you for joining us today, Lieutenant. I've watched you sitting in the back of the room as we've moved you further and further down the agenda. So I appreciate your patience.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair Morgan, and thank you for your invitation to speak before you today. Chair Morgan, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Cope. I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division, and currently I'm the interim director of the Fish and Wildlife Division. My purpose for coming before you today is to tell you a little bit about the function and purpose of the programs of the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. Just as a wee bit of history here, when created in 1931 by the Oregon legislature, the Oregon State Police was given authority and therefore the responsibility to enforce traffic, criminal, and fish and wildlife laws. The 1931 legislature saw the need to place enforcement of fish and wildlife laws in a law enforcement agency rather than a fish and wildlife management agency. So in accordance with statute authority, the purpose of the Fish and Wildlife Division is to assure compliance with laws which protect and enhance the long-term health and equitable utilization of Oregon's fish and wildlife resources. It's important to note that the Fish and Wildlife Division is the only entity in state government given the responsibility of fish and wildlife enforcement. I'd like to tell you a little bit about how we form our programs. To effectively enforce fish and wildlife laws in Oregon, a process has been developed with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, which prioritizes enforcement protection of our fish and wildlife resources. Our process is called the Cooperative Enforcement Plan. Our field officers meet with the district fisheries and wildlife biologists of ODFW, as well as other state and federal enforcement and natural resource agencies, as well as some public, and we do this on an annual basis. And the enforcement priorities are ranked on a high, medium, and low priority in relation to what the resource concern is. Once identified, action plans are written as to how the enforcement priorities will be addressed. And then after the action plan has been put into place and finished, a critique of the action plan is written to, that measures the outcome of our performance. Truly voluntary compliance is a key component of our performance measures. The Fish and Wildlife Division is made up of the commercial fish section, the wildlife section, and the aircraft section. The purpose of the commercial fish section is to enforce and protect Oregon's commercial fishery regulations and marine resources. The commercial fish section provides assistance to all fishery activity, commercial fisheries activities, charter vessels, guides, and outfitters. Coordination with local, state, and federal governments and recognized National American Tribe facilities facilitates successful accomplishments of the goals and objectives of the commercial fish section. There is an ORS that authorizes the Department of State Police to enforce criminal fishing laws, which is ORS 406511, and it pertains to licenses and permits, vessel and gear regulations, processing facilities, as well as other issues, and it's listed there in my testimony. The purpose of the wildlife section is to coordinate the formation of policy and enforce laws and regulations affecting Oregon's wildlife and sport fishery regulations. General fish and wildlife officers cooperate on local as well as statewide issues in addressing annual and unexpected fish and wildlife issues. Coordination, also there is an ORS that directs the Department of State Police to enforce angling and hunting laws, which is 496.610. Lastly, the aircraft section provides aerial support to the department, other public service safety agencies, and natural resource agencies. Local, state, and federal agencies benefit from the Oregon, from the department's aircraft section support. The Fish and Wildlife Division has four fixed-wing, aircraft assigned to strategic locations throughout the state. That's in Bend, Baker City, Central Point, and Salem. We also have an officer who is assigned to environmental crime enforcement. He's assigned to the Department of Environmental Quality as a criminal investigator. And lastly, we have a section called the Special Investigations Unit, which has responsibility for conducting complex long-term investigations of individuals or groups that are in violation of fish and wildlife laws and regulations, with specific emphasis on those violators that are exploiting or illegally commercializing Oregon's fish and wildlife resources. The Fish and Wildlife Division is very cognizant of its performance measures and has built a process which ensures that the system is accountable from the officer on the ground all the way through management to the program manager. All job-related priority activities and hours of effort expended doing those activities are tabulated on a bi-monthly basis. All this information is compiled and put together through a particular priority, as well as whatever management unit or body of water has been involved. Numbers of contacts with the public are recorded, and all noncompliance of law is documented. The Fish and Wildlife Division then puts together a monthly report, and we call this the Broadlund Report. The tracking system measures voluntary compliance in every wildlife unit and watershed. The division recognizes the compliance rate for specific species previously identified through that cooperative enforcement plan as needing priority protective measures. Through the CEP and the Broadlund Report, compliance numbers are assessed and evaluated, and action plans are structured by fish and wildlife enforcement officers, local biologists, and other affected partners for the next season. These action plans are designed and carried out with the best interest for survival of the fish and wildlife resource. A little bit about the Oregon Plan. Through the Oregon Plan, positions have been identified to provide enforcement services with all aspects of protecting salmon. A few of the duties include checking bag limits, possession limits, and licensing requirements, as well as habitat and environmental regulations. These officers, they're around the state in key locations, and they work with Water Resources Department, Division of State Lands, DEQ, and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The Fish and Wildlife Division also participates as a member of the Marine Fishery Enforcement Consultants to PFMC, or the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. In this process, the division works with other agencies such as Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, Cal Fish and Game, National Marine Fisheries, and industry representatives to structure regulations that allow for the harvest of surplus fish while protecting resources that are limited. We also are a member of the Columbia Basin Law Enforcement Committee, or CUBLIC. This committee meets to discuss enforcement of harvest and habitat laws of the Columbia River and its tributaries. These meetings are to facilitate the exchange of information and coordination of enforcement activity on the Columbia River and its tributaries. This concludes my testimony covering the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer those or get the information for you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Senator Ferriola.
Madam Chairman, I have to apologize for an unkind remark that I made as the lieutenant was seated, and the comment said, oh, it's the sausage cops. And I think I need to apologize for that comment and explain the issue to the committee. Right now we have a law on the books in Oregon that prevents Oregonians who produce elk meat and elk parts, they are elk ranchers, legally, legislatively authorized to produce that commodity. They're not allowed to sell it in Oregon because we have a statute on the books that prevents the trafficking and game animal parts. And that's been extrapolated to the point where even units of the state police have been asked to go to retail stores and check the jerky and the sausage displays to see if there are any deer or elk meat products that are being sold illegally in Oregon, and apparently there are. And I just thought that it was an odd thing to see our precious resources that are dedicated to the protection of fish and wildlife and the enforcement of game laws expanded in the pinching of packages in retail stores. So I've attempted to change the law, and I just think that ought to be an issue that people understand, that we're We fight for every dollar that goes into game enforcement. I think we ought to be spending them in this way, and in order not to have to give the chance forces out there in the Bi-Mart stores pinching the shrink wrap packages, we ought to change that law.
Madam Chair, in that regard, given the tremendous increase in poaching, as we've seen statistically in the last couple of years, I have to really echo the good senator's comments. I find that difficult to believe that we're expending precious resources to do that when we're not out there in the field enforcing the game laws. Are you intending to continue that?
Chair Morgan, Representative Kraft and Senator Farrelly, Oli, I don't want this to get really blown out of proportion. There has been a lot of discussion with regard to Senate Bill 41 regarding the sale of elk meat. And while this has been going on, we had had reports from various sources that perhaps elk meat currently was for sale in different locations in Oregon. And so one place that had been identified through a complaint was that it was for sale at a local retail store. And so we had some officers go out to confirm that. When that was confirmed, I don't want to misquote myself, but I believe it was the local biologist from the area here who talked to the store manager and asked them to voluntarily take the meat off of their shelves, which I believe they did.
Lieutenant, is there an increase in poaching according to your statistics?
Chair Morgan, committee members, yes, there has been. We have seen an increase over the last 3 years, particularly in big game.
Thank you. Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Kraft.
Coupled with poaching and increasing numbers of bear and cougar, especially cougar effect on the populations of deer and elk, I think that only underscores the continued need to have more game enforcement officers out there. Whether we provide them to you, which hopefully we're going to be able to do here, and or you retask individuals. I think it's incredibly important that for the health of Oregon's long-term herds that we're a big game, that we're able to accomplish that goal by putting more people out there. I think it's, given what's happened in the last couple of years in terms of budget issues with game enforcement officers, I think it's the message went out loud and clear to people out there who choose to ignore the law. And I think they're taking advantage of it, and we're seeing sadly seeing the fruits of that. I wanted to ask you a question about your aircraft. You have four aircraft, and how many hours a year are you flying those airplanes?
Chair Morgan, I don't believe I have that information really on the tip of my memory here. I can seek that information out for you and get it. If I could defer to my predecessor here, Captain/Director Ball, who may have that information.
Nice. I like it.
Yeah. We call it director.
I think that's referred to as a lateral aerobatic.
Very nicely executed.
Chair Morgan, representing Krupp. The aircraft in is stationed at Baker. These are estimates. They'll be both those. It flies about 750 hours a year airtime. The aircraft in Bend will be about 800 hours. The aircraft in Salem will, the hours on that plane will probably be pretty close to 1,000. The aircraft in Central Point will be less than that. I think you'll probably see that down around 400 to 500 hours.
And Madam Chair, the aircraft in Salem is which airplane?
Is that the 185?
The 185 out of here.
Tricycle gear plane.
And you've got a Super Cub also?
No, we don't have a Super Cub anymore. The last Super Cub that we had was in Bend, and that's been replaced with a 185 Cessna tricycle gear plane. The aircraft in Central Point is a 182, and the aircraft in Baker is a Cessna 180. They're all single engine,
right?
High wing plane.
Well, I
follow up.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just want to make a comment. I think that's great that you're flying them that many hours because you're truly getting the use out of the aircraft. If you were flying them less than 300 hours a year, I would question the expense of owning one. From being an aircraft owner, I can tell you that unless you're flying them, it doesn't pay to own them. So I'm glad you're using them that many hours. That's good.
Representative Hayden.
Lieutenant, can you briefly tell me what sort of training courses your game enforcement officers have and how they relate to the public with whom they come in contact and when they may and may draw their weapons in the presence of civilians?
Chair Morgan, Representative Hayden, our Fish and Wildlife officers, for those who well, let me start here at the beginning, excuse me. All of our officers, whether Fish and Wildlife or assigned to patrol or criminal, all go through the same 16-week basic recruit school. After that time, then some officers go immediately into Fish and Wildlife enforcement. Every year have a in-service, which is a week long, sometimes about 2 to 3 days, for all Fish and Wildlife members. And at this in-service, the training is, generally speaking, directed at Fish and Wildlife issues. When the officer goes out to be trained, he spends 3 to 4 months with a training officer, another officer who's assigned to Fish and Wildlife Enforcement, so there's that on-the-job training. And then, once again, every year they go to this in-service. It's a statewide in-service, and we hold it 2 separate weeks. Half the state comes 1 week, and the other half comes another week. Then what we've seen over the last few years is that due to attrition with so many of our officers retiring in a short period of time, that some of that knowledge that we so depend on isn't getting transferred to the young people. So we have developed a process called workforce development, and it's another week during the year where we bring our young people together as well as some old people and other experts out in the field and train them in knowledge that we want them to have, things from big game enforcement or how to deal with the salvaging of a big game animal, to just scenarios, different kinds of scenarios where we run our officers through different kinds of contacts that they may or may not have out in the field. The idea is not for them to be no-win type situations, that we want them to have success, but to know that there are different ways to be able to handle a situation. Could you repeat for me the other portion of your question? It has
when they are authorized to draw their weapons in the presence of unarmed civilians.
Representative Morgan, Representative Hayden, the officer is
under a call.
Authorized to draw his weapon when he or she feels a threat to themselves or another. I don't think, articulate each and every situation in which a person may or might not do that. It has to be a decision that they're making inside themselves.
Objected.
Very much so.
And Madam Chairman, if I could comment. First of all, east of the Cascades, there are no unarmed civilians. And secondly, the officers who go into the game hunting camps are expected. You know, there's respect to be checked in the field. And there have been some issues of and questions about officers entering camps in a defensive posture, but their training is thorough and their training is for the safety of the civilian as well as the officer. Now, as far as I know, there's not been an incident of violence involving a game officer encountering hunters or civilians in quite some time in Oregon. So the training is obviously working.
If I might interject, Senator, we, the House members, are under a call to go to the Senate floor. I'll pass the gavel to you and trust that you
go to the Senate floor.
We'll be back.
We will continue as a subcommittee of the committee. Anyway, so I guess I'd just ask the captain and the lieutenant to talk about the, for the record, the issue of safety training and has there been any encounters that have generated any incidences that, such as the representative indicated.
Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, I haven't been closely assigned to the agency for the last few months. Prior to that, nothing comes to mind right away where we've had to use deadly physical force when checking hunters. In fact, there's been many times when people in the public safety arena that have made comments to me personally, how in the world can you go out and enforce laws on people who possess firearms? And quite the contrary, I'm very comfortable around hunters who have firearms. There hasn't been a problem for me personally with hunters in that respect. And I have never had to use my weapon against a hunter in a routine check of that nature.
I'm not even aware of an issue where a game officer has had to unholster a weapon and checking game violations, but maybe you are aware of this.
Chair Ferrioli, when you asked your question, I wasn't sure you were referring to just the last few months. I'm certain that one or more of our officers may have been involved in like a felony stop where they may have backed up a patrol officer and certainly their weapon would have been drawn at that point. That's just our standard procedure. But again, I can echo the captain here, and I don't know of any thing in the last few months where we've had any kind of a altercation with a hunter out in the field.
Question?
Yes.
Senator Dukes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the airplanes. How many of the four that you mentioned have clear capabilities to
pilot? Chair Ferrioli, Senator Dukes, I don't believe any of them do at this time. The only FLIR I believe we had was assigned to another aircraft, not one of the Fish and Wildlife aircraft, at least to my knowledge. Oh.
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Dukes, I might be able to add to that. The department was in possession of a forward-looking infrared machine that was fitted to the 185 Cessna aircraft. That piece of equipment was on loan from Bonneville Power Administration to search out people that were illegally gill netting on the Columbia River. When the Bonneville Power Administration contract expired in 1997 with the Department of State Police, that equipment that was on loan was recovered by Bonneville Power, and they now use that piece of equipment in their helicopter as they fly and survey their power lines. We no longer have that piece of equipment.
Every once in a while, there's a discussion about what are the population of elk in this area, and there's a debate over that, or when we're talking about listing some species, how many of the little four-footed critters are there really? I thought that in doing some of those estimates that we were using FLIR. You're telling me we're not?
Chair Farioli, Senator Dukes, there were some experiments that I'm aware of on in the North Coast where a aircraft, and I believe it was the National Guard, loaned, or we worked cooperatively with them on some experimental census routes using a FLIR. Beyond that, I would have to defer to our Wildlife Division and the Department of Fish and Wildlife to give you further report on that.
Okay. I know this isn't cheap equipment, but how expensive is it?
Chair Farioli, Senator Dukes, the FLIR equipment that was on loan to us from Bonneville Power Administration was valued, as I recall, at $151,000.
I'd be interested sometime in the future as to whether or not you think that would be something worth our while to own. I mean, it seems to me it would be, but I don't necessarily know how often it could be used. We have, today we worry a lot about how many there are of a lot of different critters. Well, I suppose you're probably not going to use this for fish. Still a lot of the four plants, there's probably still a lot of four-footed critters out there that we need to know how many there are, and in some cases how many there are in particular regions. So it seems to me that it would be worthwhile, but perspective on that.
Chair Farioli, Senator Dukes, I would say currently today it would be a nice to have rather than a have to have for our census routes and census taking of wildlife.
Okay, because I'm not too impressed with your two studies. Some of the other things that we're doing on deer and elk. We give extra permits to people so they can go out and kill deer and we can get two samples, and then they sort of forget to send in the two samples. I sort of wonder how come we're giving them the permits, but the system works so we don't get accurate two samples. There'll be better ways to do some of this. Thank you.
Okay. Shall we continue?
Chair Farioli, Senator Dukes, our next presenter is Jim Lamka with the Administrative Services Division.
Thank you, Lieutenant Cope.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Lamka.
Good morning.
Let me confer with staff for a minute. The Senate session starts at 11,
mm-hmm.
and we're subject clock also. So we'll probably continue here until we are called. If we are called, I think probably the intelligent thing to do would be to see how far we can get through this agenda, possibly adjourn. Mr. Lamka, your presentation will take approximately how long?
The way I have it prepared will be about 8 or 9 minutes.
Oh, please proceed.
Questions. We are excused.
I could do it.
Whether we're excused from the call or not, I can't tell you, yeah. But I did get us excused yesterday.
I think it depends on the bill.
That could be. That could be.
Chair Farioli, I could make it very quickly if you...
Oh, let's have the full 8 minutes,
yeah.
Sir.
Chair Farioli, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lamka. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm here today to give you a brief overview of the Administration Division, and in your presentation notebook, that starts on page 54 if you want to follow along. I won't read that to you, but let me summarize. The mission of the Administration Division is to provide the support services for the day-to-day operations of the department. We achieve this through the services provided through the Director's Office and the sections for Human Resources, Information and Education, Administrative Services, and Information Systems. The Governor's base budget for administration is about $22 million with 92 FTE. This represents about 12% of the dollars and 11% of the FTE. The Director's Office provides leadership and sets the strategic direction for the entire agency. It works with tribal governments at the statewide, regional, and local level. It coordinates policy issues with the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission and the Governor's Office, and it provides legislative monitoring and coordination for the agency. Our Human Resources section is staffed with 8 FTE and provides a full range of human resource services and programs for employees and applicants. These programs and services include recruitment, selection, classification, compensation, affirmative action and diversity, employee benefits, safety and health, and employee training and organizational development. Some of the major accomplishments of our human resource section include the development and implementation of core competencies for all department employees, revisions to strengthen the existing agency ethics policy, and the development of a new policy to address concerns regarding employee participation in certain activities, developing and updating all human resource policies on a regular recurring cycle. Our information and education section is staffed with 15 FTE. It promotes the support of fish and wildlife resources by fostering public understanding and participation in natural resource issues. Its programs include information and media services, which provides information to the public, and outdoor skill programs, which include hunter education, aquatic and angler education, and our Becoming an Outdoors Woman policy. These programs are delivered statewide through a large volunteer network. The information and education section produces a number of products that include the bi-monthly Oregon Wildlife Magazine, quarterly accomplishment report to the legislature called the Fish and Wildlife Monitor, a bi-monthly employee newsletter, and numerous audio and visual materials. Some of the major accomplishments of our information and education section include that they coordinated the agency's strategic planning efforts and designed and printed our strategic plan called Vision 2006, and a copy of that is in the back of your presentation notebook. They helped establish a scholarship at Oregon State University using donated funds. They published Access Oregon, a new brochure, which brought a copy with me. It outlines the information about disabled accessible sites that people can visit in Oregon to view wildlife or participate in fish and wildlife activities. And they assisted with the critical role of editing and writing for the Natural Resource Division staff. Our administrative services section is staffed with 36 FTE. It provides administrative support to the department through its budget and finance unit, licensing unit, and business services unit. The administrative services section is responsible for several critical items. First, a sound accounting system. We use the statewide accounting system, and we maintain the official accounting system for the agency. In that regard, we record revenues and deposits the funds in the state treasury. We record expenditures and track them by user-defined cost centers. We distribute a monthly cost center detail report from the statewide accounting system that shows expenditures at a detailed program level. We provide agency-wide reports from the statewide accounting system, both to our commission and to the executive leadership team. And we provide internal controls and account reconciliations to validate the accounting records. We also work with individual managers who may maintain their own notes and spreadsheets to make sure that they're in they're reconciled with our statewide system. Second critical item is good business and budget practices that promote accountability. Third, efficient business systems. This would include things like purchasing, risk management, real estate, and motor pool activities. Fourth, responsive and efficient licensing services for the public. And fifth, acquisition of land to provide habitat and enhanced citizen access. Some of the major accomplishments of the administrative services section include that we develop plans and are in the process of implementing action to reorganize and consolidate our budget and fiscal activities for better efficiency and standardization. And we're developing training for headquarters and field staff on key financial and business activities. We've developed new reports to establish accountability first to our commission, We provide a monthly report to them that details revenues and expenditures and projections for the biennium, and also to our executive leadership team, where we provide details by program and by region on expenditures compared to budget. We recently developed reports to show dedicated and obligated fund balances and also a cash flow projection. We've received the Department of Administrative Services Gold Star Award for statewide financial reporting excellence, and we've received that for 9 consecutive years. Our information systems section is staffed with 28 FTE. The mission of this section is to provide technology planning, evaluation, and consulting to assist the department in accomplishing its mission. Information system delivers its programs in 4 areas: work and technical services, applications and maintenance, point of sale licensing system, and hotline and computer operations, which provides 24-hour a day, 7-day per week technical and program support, both for the agency computer operations and also for our point of sale licensing system. Some of the major accomplishments of our information system section includes Y2K compliance of all of our computer systems that delivered uninterrupted services to our customers.